welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for April 23rd. It's brought to you by Shooters in Nagoya. I'm John Gibson, and back from vacation is Jim Allen. What's happening, buddy?
Aloha.
Aloha. How was Hawaii?
It was very nice, and we got back in one piece, or two separate pieces. Exactly.
Two pieces of one hole.
Yeah. There's a hole somewhere, and it still hurts.
All right, well, first let me say thanks to Michael Westbay for sitting in.
Thank you, Mike. Enjoyed the show, Mike. Good job.
Yeah, good job. Good job.
As well as Jim Ross to you.
Thank you very much, sir. This week we've got an interview with Seth Greisinger of the Lotte Marines. We're going to touch on the 2000 Hitmen and hit a few other topics of our own. And we're also going to answer a good listener question. So let's get started by clearing the bases. All right. So I got to sit down with Seth Greisinger the other day at Chiba. I guess it's called QVC Marine Field. It's changing names all the time.
That's right. So it's at U.S. Home Shopping Network now.
Now, he joined the Marines in the off season in what seems like an exodus of foreign players from the Nomiuri Giants.
Seems.
Either they were all kicked out, booted out, or just ran away.
Man, that's a good
question.
All of
the above.
Perhaps, yeah.
Seth is a two-time league leader in wins. He led the Central League in wins with the Swallows, and he did it with the Giants. His first two, three seasons in Japan, really good numbers, and then he's dropped off. He's had 16 wins, 17 wins, and 13 wins, and then he's had injury trouble, to be honest.
Right.
But he's 49 and 30. Since 2007 when he joined Yakko, that's a pretty good record. That's a pretty good piece to not have on your team if you're the Giants. Hint, hint.
Well, you know, things, I'll mention a few of these later after we hear the interview, but, he's always a very upbeat, positive guy, and he has share, like a lot of people, ball players sometimes get weird situations, and he's had his share. With the Giants particularly.
Well, he's been healthy recently. He's been able to enjoy some success whenever he's been healthy. I don't know. I think I undervalued Lotte's rotation, you know, when we were doing our preseason picks.
Right.
Greisinger was one of the ingredients I just overlooked.
Yeah.
And he's pitched well. Fujioka, the rookie, and a healthy Hayden Penn. And those guys are a big reason the Marines have started well.
Hayden Penn has been a mystery because he's been hurt. He also has had these nicks and dings and things going on. And every time he's pitched, he's been superb. And he just keeps the ball on the ground like crazy. And he's done very, very well. And the problem is he just hasn't pitched very much.
Yeah, he's been hurt. He gets hurt.
Yep.
But Seth went 7 innings in his first start on April 4th, and then his next start he went 8 innings. So he's got two quality starts, both wins for the team. They skipped him the last time out because there was a rainout, and he decided he actually agreed to be skipped in the rotation so that other guys could stay on schedule. So that was really nice of him, and he was gracious enough to sit down and talk to me for about 5 or 6 minutes. So let's take a listen to the interview. All right, I'm here with Seth Greisinger. He's with the Lotte Marines this year. And how did you end up here?
Well, after I left the Giants last year, I was talking to a couple different teams, and Chiba was one of the teams that expressed the most interest. And, I really was trying to stay around in or around Tokyo, which only left, four or five teams. And Chiba just seemed to be the best situation, and they showed the most interest. And it just worked out. I knew Saburo because he was with the Giants last year, and he kind of talked to me about coming over. And I said I would, I'd love to play for Chiba. And so I think, I think he had a little bit of influence with it, and it worked out well, and it's been great so far.
Now, how do you like this team?
I love it. I like the manager. He's stuck with me all spring, just kind of let me do what I need to do to get ready, and then the pitching coach has been great, working with me in the bullpens and helping me with my curveball. It's just a little bit more relaxed atmosphere, and the guys, like to have fun, which is always nice. More Western-style baseball. So it's a lot of fun, and I love playing outside. I love playing in Jingu because it was outside. And I like playing here, too. The only downside is the rainouts.
Which comes sometimes. Now, now tell me about this team's title chances. Are they talking title?
Well, I think with 12 teams, you know, six in each league, I think every team at the beginning of the season, their goal is to win the title. So I think that was our goal to start the season. And I think this first two, 3 weeks, it's kind of been reassured that, you know, the ball that we're playing shows that we have the potential to win the title, especially with our pitching staff. So I think that's, you know, only, like I said, reinforced that goal. You know, but it's a long season. You know, we're only 15 games into a 144-game schedule. So, you know, we probably won't get serious until, you know, August, September, July, somewhere around there.
Now, you talked about the pitching staff. Evaluate yourself. You've had two starts and you've done pretty well.
I've done well. You know, it's always nice to start the season off well, but I've always been the type of guy that has a slow start and then gets going halfway through, you know, in the end. And I hope that's the case this year, where I, you know, generally get stronger as the year goes on. But it's always nice to start off the season, you know, with a couple good starts. It helps to solidify my spot in the rotation, one, and then it also helps the team get off to a good start. But with this team, it's there's a lot of pressure because the young guys at the front of the rotation seem to throw 130, 140 pitches and throw nine innings every time. So when you go out and only go seven, it doesn't look great. But I think they, you know, they know the expectations, or they know our expectations, and you know, and they've been supportive in letting us, you know, stick with our pitch counts. And they know it's a long season, the pitching coach and the manager. So it's been great, and you know, hopefully. You know, that I can learn something from our top pitchers and help them if they ever need it.
Now, how are you physically? I know you had to deal with a lot of injuries while you were with the Giants.
I feel pretty good. I mean, I felt good all last year. You know, the last year I felt strong. I even felt my strongest at the end of the year. So I was ending the year on a good note, and had a lot of confidence coming into this year. And so I've been able to kind of be a little bit more proactive in my bullpens in the spring, and you know, challenge my arm a little bit more early on in the season, you know, with 113 pitches my last start. But with that said, I'm still taking it day by day, and my main goal is just to stay healthy all season, because if I can do that, I know I can have success, especially on this, you know, this team.
Now, talk about your time with the Giants. I mean, I know you were injured. What was different injury? Elbows and different issues. How was your time with the Giants? How do you reflect on that?
It was good. You know, I love all the players on the team. I had some good teammates, and I enjoyed my time there. It was 4 years. It was just unfortunate my third year that I had the elbow issue, had surgery at the beginning of the year, which kind of took me out the entire year. And then last year they had a good rotation, and you know, it was just difficult to break it. You know, unfortunately, didn't really end on a good note, but it was, you know, it was good. I'm glad to be here, though. You know, it's definitely a different atmosphere, a lot more relaxed, and I really enjoy playing here.
Now, how long are you planning to play this game?
I don't know. You know, it was my last year in Korea, I think, or even my first half year in Korea, you know, is when I was really considering what I wanted to do after baseball.
And what year was that?
That was 2005 or 2004. And so every year I've tried to, you know, somehow come up with ideas of what I want to do when I finish playing baseball, and it's just kind of been a year-to-year thing. And I always tell myself at the end of the year, if I'm healthy and still having fun, you know, there's a good chance I'll try it one more year. That's what happened last year. I ended really healthy. I pitched great all year long. I just couldn't get into the major leagues, and got stronger as the year went on. And at the end of the year, I just said, well, I'm still having fun, I'm healthy, and if I can get a shot to, you know, make a rotation somewhere, I'll take it and see what happens. And then, you know, I'll see what happens at the end of this year, you know, where I stand health-wise, and if I'm still having fun.
Well, now, you said the gig with the Giants didn't end well. I mean, on a good note, you said. How did that play out?
I don't know. It's I don't really want to get into
it. They weren't looking to sign you, or you were...
It was a little bit of both. I don't think any foreigner really wanted to go back. You know, Rami left, I left, Carlos left, Rusty left, Albedejo left. So it just wasn't a good experience at all last year. I think they were aware of that, as well as we were. I think Dickie was the only guy that signed back. You know, and I don't know if he had an option to go anywhere else or not because of the contract. But it is what it is, and you know, like I said, I got along with all the players. They have a great team. You know, it was just a couple coaches that didn't always see eye to eye, and you know, and so, but it's worked out well. Hopefully, both parties. You know, they have some good foreigners over there, and I enjoy playing here.
All right. Well, we enjoy watching you. We enjoy having you sit with us. Thank you very much. We'll see you later.
Okay. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right. Thanks again, Seth, for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's good seeing you too, buddy.
Good hearing you, Seth. I mean, I could picture you there talking.
We'll see you someday. Now, he said he's healthy, and he said that with a huge smile on his face. And that's what I'm noticing, because Michael Nakamura, the lost but not forgotten reliever who was with the closer for the Nippon Ham Fighters and went to the Giants and basically disappeared, has reemerged with this team. And he was smiling and beaming, too, just to be able
with
to...
With the Lions.
With the Lions now, yeah. And he was smiling and beaming just to be able to be out there and be on the big club and be pitching again. And I see this as a theme with all these former Giants players. They all look bright and cheery. I don't know why that is.
Yeah. Well, because they're not in last place.
Ba-dum-bum.
Although, who would have thunk it? And there's a long way to go before... before we put the nail in that coffin.
Oh, yeah. I don't think we're even measuring for the coffin right at the
No, point. I don't think so.
But, yeah, the teams that we both picked to finish on top in respective leagues are kicking around in the cellar at the moment. But, yeah, it's a...
Now, ain't that something? Huh. Okay.
So, what'd you pick up from the interview that you wanted to discuss?
Well, you know... Scott had,
Seth.
Seth. Who the heck is
Scott? To his friends.
No, Scott to the moron on the podcast can't remember people's names because of early onset Alzheimer's. Okay. Let's call him Scott next time. Okay, I'll go.
Onset vacationitis is what you've got.
Okay. Okay, anyway, so Seth had success with the Swallows and then with the Giants, but weird things happened with the Giants. And last year they were in a spot where they needed one foreign starter at one point, and they basically gave up on him. You know, they gave him a few chances, and the year before they gave him a few chances, and it was like every time he came into a game last year, I'll tell you, talk about weird stuff going on. He came into, I'm going to say it was three games, and he got whacked. He got hit with line drives. He got all kinds of weird stuff happened to him last year in 2010. So last year, he comes in and he pitches, I don't know, he's up and down and things are weird and they send him down and he pitches really, really well in the farm team. But they've already given up on him. They're basically waiting for Dickie Gonzalez to get healthy enough. So, and Dickie Gonzalez, fair enough, was razor sharp when he came back up. So they made the right choice in that respect, but Seth was really pouring on down there, and they couldn't care less. So as far as I think, it was absolutely a case of they didn't want him on the team last summer. So I'm sure they didn't want him on the team over the winter.
Yeah. I mean, you could tell that. And I don't think he wanted to get into it. He actually said he didn't want to get into it.
Okay. Well,
but, yeah, I think the parting was mutual. And I looked at his last outings with the Giants, and he lost four straight decisions in six appearances between June and July.
Right.
And in there were only two quality starts, and he was 0-1 in those starts. So, I mean, I have to believe they thought that they had better options.
Right.
And you're right, they gave up on him. Because Michael Nakamura, you know, who was with him on the farm team last year with the Giants, said he was throwing 150 at one point, which Seth is not, you know, he's not the hardest thrower out there.
He doesn't usually hit 144, 145 is usually, he sits there 147.
Right. And he likes to go with the changeup, and I don't remember him throwing, you know, fastballs by people, but if he's hitting 150 down the farm,
yeah,
you know, they probably could have used somebody like that if he was,
they probably
he was
figured
effective,
he was throwing,
his effective 150.
They were probably figuring he was throwing too hard.
Maybe trying too hard to get up there. I don't know.
Anyways, it was weird. And so, yeah, the interesting thing here is the Marines being a more American style team.
That you picked on up on that too. I did too. I don't know if he said they play more American style, but
oh, okay.
But me, well, that's what he said. But to me, I thought maybe their preparation is more like American.
I doubt it. I wonder. I think it's more American style. If it's more American style, it's a more American style in the sense that. I don't know. In some management sense, it's less rigid. There's less, I don't know what, more play ball and what you do on the field matters than what you do on the sidelines, perhaps. I'm trying to piece it out because Nishimura is a very Japanese style manager, and that was a big thing of his thing after Valentine was that he was a Japanese style manager.
Right.
But yeah, so I don't know. I'm trying to interpret that somehow, and I don't really have a good solution. Anyway, it was interesting to hear that.
I did too, and you know, it hit me. And like I said, the first thing I thought was, okay, well, I know that the Giants, because Michael Nakamura told me this, that when he went there, it was an adjustment, a huge adjustment for him to do what they wanted him to do in terms of getting ready for games.
Okay.
And that he had his own routine, and he was taken out of that comfort zone of doing his own routine. And perhaps with the Lions, maybe in the preparation phase, that right. They allow these foreign players to do it, to get ready the way they want. And maybe that's what they're saying, what he means by American style.
Well, he did talk, Michael has talked a little bit about the culture shock of moving from Trey Hillman's Fighters to the Giants.
Yeah, as anyone would.
Yeah, it was. It's a different thing, and everybody has. I wouldn't say everybody, but many of the players have had their horror stories. Even you know the nicest guys have had some things that have some things in there between the lines about some of the weird stuff that goes on in the Omiuri clubhouse.
Well, yeah. Now Seth always also talked about the fact that things don't get serious until July, August, September, and I don't know. I beg to differ. Now, he said that. I mean,
Seriously, okay. Go ahead.
I think pennant race wise.
Okay, that's what I thought we were talking about. Okay.
Right, pennant race wise, he said that you know, things don't get serious until July, August, September. But maybe for starting pitchers who work maybe once a week. But I contend that you know if you're an everyday player and you know you're hovering around 200, not getting it going, and it's you know it's July, I think you're going to find yourself. On the farm team in July.
Seriously.
Don't have it going there.
Yeah, seriously. I think that is. I think that's the, it's a matter of perspective. The games are just as important now as they are at the end of the season, except that there's the perspective is you can't make up a 20, you know, you can't make up a 15 game, difference with 10 games left to go.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got 140 games left to go, you think, "Oh, okay, we're not finished," you know. So that's part of the deal there. So it's a perspective issue. The games are just as important. So I think that's you know it's just a matter of right now nothing's crucial. The wins you can't see who you're competing for the pennant race, but mm-hmm. yeah, you know. They plan to be in it, and I'm going to mention a little later, you know, some of the dynamic of playing in a 6-team league is that half the teams are going to make the playoffs.
Yeah, unfortunately. Or fortunately, I don't know.
Fortunately, why not? Fortunately. Yeah. That's
I mean,
funny.
It used to have no meaning to be an A-class team, which is the top finishing in the top three. And
you got to start the next season at home.
It meant nothing. But now it actually has some meaning and some bearing, but... You know, I also say that this, I know the games have just as much meaning and wins and losses have just as much meaning now as then, but if you get off to a really bad start, you might not, you know, whether you get off to a good start or not, you might not lose the pennant in April or May, but you really, you fall down and it's hard to get up.
Well, you lose it whenever you can lose it in April as easily as you can lose it in September. So, again, that's sure you can lose the pennant in April. I mean, you can lose it. Now the difference is that there's always a chance for a miracle. The chances for miracles start, you know, your chances of a miracle decreases with each day.
Of course.
So, but you could lose it just as easily in April as you can in September. It's just that it's not final until September. It's not on the wall till September, but it doesn't mean those games. Anyway, that's just philosophical stuff, and so we can just move on, I think, from that.
All right. Well, I mean, I remember this is still the team that in 2010 finished in third place and then went on to win the Japan Series. So
yeah, because they won what 18 of their last 20. They won about 15 of their last 20 games.
And then they made a run in the playoffs.
Well, that's what I mean. They just blew. They were red hot in the postseason. They were red hot from game 142, the last three games of the regular season and the rest of the postseason, and that was enough.
So it is possible to get through that third place gauntlet and get to the Japan Series. Once you get there, you know, things are on, you know, even ground then.
Well, no, nothing's ever even, but you've got a chance. I mean, that's the thing. And you get the fewer innings you play, the fewer games you're in, the less important quality is, the less of a factor quality and ability and all that is, because random chance just has such a huge impact in such a small space of time.
I agree. Well, good luck to Seth, and we appreciate him talking to us. Now we're going to move on to the group I like to call the Milestoners.
The Milestoners? There's nothing mild about these guys. Oh, Milestoners. Oh, okay, Gibson. Okay, I'm on to okay, I got you, man.
We got a trio of guys. Actually, there are four of them.
Well,
chasing 2,000 hits, I remind you, I don't remember if it was episode 2 or episode 3, and I said I didn't think Rami-chan was going to get to 2,000 hits this year, right. And he's having a slow start. Now, this no guarantee, but he's having a slow start. That's all I wanted to point out. But he is among our quartet.
Well, Miyamoto had a red hot start, and he's not any closer now than he was 2 weeks ago, practically.
Yeah, and people keep asking about it, and I'm going to probably see another guy on this list who's the closest now is Atsunori Inaba of the Fighters.
Right.
And he's just raking out of control right now. He's in Triple Crown territory after the first month. You know, he's up there in batting average and RBIs as well as as home runs, and he's hot. He's hot. He's the man. Shinya Miyamoto of the Swallows, and we've got Hiroki Kokubo of the SoftBank Hawks and Alex Ramirez of the Yokohama Bay Stars. And those are the guys who are approaching 2,000 hits now. We talked about Miyamoto before. I wanted to start with him anyway, though. He's a great contact hitter, and I don't know. The one story I wanted to tell about him was a couple years ago when I interviewed him, and he mentioned some things to me about not having to be the star to be a winner.
Right.
And, you know, he talked about the fact that whether the team is winning or the team is losing, everybody can't get a hit in every game.
Right. Right.
But what you can do is you can hit the cutoff man. You can back up on relay plays where you're supposed to be. You can run the bases hard. You can stay on your toes on defense. Everybody has to do those things.
Yep.
But not everybody has to get a hit for us to win. And
well, what you need is to have, I mean, and what the little things are include things at the plate, obviously, because hits don't happen by accident. Well, actually, they frequently do happen by accident.
Thank you very much. Every pitcher who's hit a home run. No, I'm kidding.
But I'm saying that, you know, it's basically doing the right things, having good at bats, being well positioned, being, you know, having your head in the game, paying attention. Those, you know, that's really what Miyamoto's game is all about.
As well as getting, I mean, you know, for him to be getting close to 2,000 hits is quite an accomplishment for a guy who, I think when we talked about him before, we said he wasn't the most athletic. He's not the one that I would have picked out of that Swallows group, in the 2000s, in the early 2000s to, stick around so long. I would have thought he would have been the guy to go, you know, to have a fairly marginal career and then disappear.
Yeah. I mean, his career it's interesting. His career really didn't take off until he was about 29 years old. So he never, you know, he's a 284 hitter in his career, but he never hit over 284 until he was 29. He just hit this streak. He became a fairly good high average hitter, you know, about the time he passed 30. So it's really peculiar. He was always a decent glove. He was basically the number two. He came up as the number two guy in the Swallows order, the designated bunter.
Mm-hmm. Just a guy. Don't mind me. Nothing to see here.
He had a good, you know, he had a reputation for a smart player. You know, he was a smart guy. And that was basically what his job was to be the smart guy in the middle of the infield. And I think there's a lot of, you know, we can talk about who's the most athletic. Someday I'll learn how to speak English properly. Well, the most athletic.
I can get you some lessons.
Thank you. Yeah, sure. Help a brother out, dude. Okay. He's not the most athletic person, but I think there is something to be said for having a guy in the middle of your team's defense who has a lot of smarts, who has poise and intelligence. And that's Miyamoto.
So
I mean, do it. The people who do the right things don't have to be, or can make up for a lot of mistakes they don't make. They could be, you know, they're on the spot, they're in the right place at the right time, they're doing, as you say, the little things. Well, he does a lot of little things right. So.
Yeah,
more power to him.
Good luck to him. Now, Inaba is probably going to get to 2000 first.
Okay.
And I'll probably see him this week at Tokyo Dome, and I'll probably try to ask him a couple questions, and there'll be like 50 other reporters crowding in. We'll have
that's
to
a drag.
Which is bad. But he is the one thing I remember about him. Well, there are two things. One is the story that Alex Ramirez always tells regarding when Alex first came over to Japan.
I was going to tell that story. Okay, go ahead.
All right, you tell that one. I'll tell the Micah Hoffpower story. When Micah Hoffpower joined the Fighters, and the first thing he did was point to Inaba, and he says, "Look at a guy like this, man. I can't believe a veteran player like this brings this much professionalism to the team." He said, you know, he doesn't have to be out there doing base running drills. He doesn't have to be out there doing some of the drills. He acts like he's like the last guy on the team, the way he works. And that's not just in front of, you know, it's not out, just out on the field in the warm-ups before the games. It's after practices. It's during games. He's just the ultimate professional. And Micah Hoffpower really looked up to Inaba when he joined the Fighters. And you know, I know every time I talk to him, he's just such a pleasure to talk to, such a stand-up guy, always willing to give you a few minutes. And that's why I feel sorry for him. I'm sure he's really raking the way he is right now at this pace to get this thing over with so he doesn't get hounded by the press, you know, for a whole month waiting to get that 2000th hit. But, the one story I wanted to tell.
He was one of the things that's kind of interesting is that, well, there's a couple of things about Inaba that, you know, I think we should remember. First thing is that when he came up with the Swallows in the mid-90s, the manager was Katsuya Nomura, and Katsuya Nomura is a typically positive and upbeat way of dealing with players, said, "I'm not going to let this jerk screw up my defense by playing in the outfield. He's going to be a first baseman," when he came out of college and after he raked around the minor leagues for a year and a half. So Nomura basically said, "No, you're a first baseman. You don't know how to play the outfield, of course." And he basically practiced his way into playing the outfield. And in 2001, 5 years later, Alex Ramirez signs with the Swallows, and he signed because he had been a part-time, he had been a major league fifth outfielder, but his specialty was right field. He had a lot of pride in his arm. He's a former pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm gonna play right field. And the coach says, "No, you're gonna be left. We want you to play left field." He says, no, I'm right fielder." So he goes out to right field and he's taking flies with Inaba. It was, I don't know, after, I don't remember his story, whether it was after one day or
Oh, it was the first day, baby. Yeah,
it was after, the first day. But not saying it was after one day or one minute. Take outfield, and he says he's watched that. He says, "Okay, I'm gonna go play left field."
Yep, I think I'm gonna walk my big butt over across the field and play left.
So now Inaba was the last year. I referred a couple of times to Seiichi Ichikawa being the first Central League star in his prime to go to the Pacific League as a free agent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Inaba, of course, is a star who came from the Central League to the Pacific League as a free agent, but he really wasn't a star when it happened, and he didn't plan to go to the Pacific League.
Yeah.
So he was what was going on with him was he wanted to play in the majors. He'd spent the Swallows have had a long time, had a working relationship with the Cleveland Indians, and Inaba was fairly injury prone and missed a lot of playing time. And he, in the off season, would spend time working at the Cleveland Indians training facility in Arizona. And so he was familiar with them. He really wanted to play in the majors. After 2004 season, he had a kind of a comeback year that year. It was okay. It was nothing special. He'd missed a lot of playing time in two of the previous three seasons, and no major league team gives him a guaranteed contract. Okay, he comes, so he says, I'm not going to play for the Swallows again. I've already been there, done that. So the Fighters show some interest, and he goes to the Fighters.
Mm-hmm.
He has a season which is a typical year for him. Now, this is a typical year for him moving from the Central League, a hitter's park in the Central League, to a pitcher's park in the Pacific League.
Mm-hmm.
But he has an Inaba-like season, which is actually a step up for a guy who is now 35 years old.
Yeah, he had 271. He had 15 homers.
Right.
That
was him. I mean, not really great average. I mean, when he was a real young, you know, when he was a puppy, he was a close to 300 hitter with 18, 19, 20 home runs and this and that, all that and the other going on. And he developed into, as we said, a very good outfielder with the Swallows. Never wins a golden glove in the Central League.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he goes to the Fighters at the age of 35. He starts playing hitting the way he did when he was a kid. And 2006, he wins the first of four straight golden gloves.
Yep.
And he is one of the best players in the Pacific League. And in fact, he was probably the best player in the Pacific League 2007 when Darvish was the MVP. He was probably the best player on the Fighters.
334.
He's been a remarkable player for them. You know, after the Major League said you're done.
Yeah.
So he's a kind of interesting story, and of course he and Miyamoto were teammates with the Swallows. They came up more or less at the same time. So, a lot of talent there then. Yeah. Back in the day.
Well, I think if this page is updated, which it's not, so I have to do some math, but he's at least at 7. I don't know how many hits he had in Sunday's games, but he's the closest, and he'll probably, you know, if he stays on the pace that he's been since the beginning of the season, probably by next weekend we'll be talking about him as the 2,000 hit guy.
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of them. I mean, those three who are really close, and there's another guy who's not that far away. He probably won't get it this year, but there's two guys who probably won't get it this year, but probably will get it next year, and two of them if one of them can continue to squat and catch. It's Motonobu Tanishige, who's now about 100 and change.
Hey, just so mean.
He's old, and B, he's a catcher.
Oh, so you're talking catcher dog years, or dog catcher years.
Well, you know, actually, catchers are kind of an odd, they're a paradox for a lot of different reasons, but one of them is that if you're a veteran catcher, if you're a veteran catcher and you're not catching every day, every inning, they have very long careers. Because guys who can really catch are hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's that old, who's smart enough to play so far past his prime, I mean, he's passed a couple of players' primes.
Wow.
You know, has really got on the ball. And those guys, they've got to hang up the glove. Nobody can take it away from them. So he's probably going to make it next year. And Alex Ramirez, who is now 140-something, it's not likely he's going to get it this year, but I wouldn't put it past him. He's usually a big second half guy, so he's possible. He's possible. Tanishige, I think, is unlikely.
We'll have to go back and listen to that show, but I believe we bet something like an Outback dinner or something, because it looks like I'm going to win that bet. So I would really like to cash in on my bet that Alex Ramirez wasn't going to get to 2,000 this year. But I'll go back and check that show. I think I could do that. Look, I like your face. A bet?
This is radio. I don't have a face. Or I have a face for radio. Okay.
All right, so, yeah, let's get to Kokobo. I just was amazed at the fact that this guy, because a lot of times power hitters or guys who start out by hitting a lot of home runs early in their careers and they don't do it anymore.
Right.
Seem to fade fast in my mind. I don't know if that's true in Japan so much. I haven't paid attention, but I just remember the young Kokobo and how he was just unstoppable. And then now he's just a guy who, he's not a power hitter. You know, you might drive a gap once in a while. You might get a
hold. I think the tax laws put a halt, kind of slowed him down a little bit.
Man, you know, the people are going to come after you, man.
Well, I mean, he'll be the first one to tell you.
Okay, yeah, I'm sure he will. He'll be the first one to tell you, too.
he's a good guy. Well, as far as good career for a power hitter, yeah, yes and no. I mean, he's not really much of a power hitter now.
No, not at all.
And to be honest, I think he was one of the reasons that the Pacific League started switching more and more to the Mizuno Bowl after 1995 was because 1995 he led the Pacific League with 28 home runs.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of had a real interesting, diverse career. I think the thing about Kokobo is diversity. Okay, now he's right now, he and Miyamoto last autumn won Golden Gloves, although why Kokobo won a Golden Glove at first base is kind of a mystery because nobody really deserved one. But he became the oldest Pacific League player to win a Golden Glove, and Miyamoto extended his record as the oldest Golden Glove winner in Japan.
I thought he was the oldest first-time winner of a Golden Glove at third. But I don't remember. I didn't write the story, so.
Well, first of all, that could have been, but I mean, he's won it three times in a row, so he's the oldest Golden Glove winner.
Okay.
In the Central League. And Kokobo's the oldest in the Pacific League, although I'm not certain. Anyway, Kokobo won his first Golden Glove the way a lot of players win their first Golden Gloves, because they are healthy and none of the competition is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only six teams in the league. So they got, you know, it's not necessarily a case that they have to give it to somebody, but they are inclined to give it to somebody, and if there's somebody who's not the worst player in the league, they'll give it to him. Now, Kokobo won a Golden Glove basically in his second year as a pro,
mm-hmm.
because there weren't any other really good quality second basemen in the league. And Akinori Iwamura won a Golden Glove, and this is a guy who pretty much couldn't throw to first base. You know, without throwing the ball or booting the ball. He was a terror in the minor leagues as a hitter, Aki was, but he just his defense was a shambles, and they couldn't play him. He was stuck in the minors for about 3 years because they had nowhere to put him.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he wins a Golden Glove, and it energizes his career because he realized, oh, I must be pretty good.
Right.
But he won one of those Kokobo awards. Well, Kokobo's was at second base, which is kind of interesting, because you look at him now, it's hard to imagine him as a second baseman.
Hard to imagine him doing anything around the middle of the infield except running to second base.
Right, well, he was, yeah, indeed. Well, he was a second baseman for a couple of years. Actually, his first year he played more in the outfield, and then he was second baseman. And he As I said, 95, he led the Pacific League with 28 home runs, which was one more than Troy Neal of the Oryx Blue Wave, who won the league that year, and three more, this kind of, I don't know, kick of this, three more than a trio of guys, Yukio Tanaka, he's a 2000 hit guy, Kiyoshi Hatsushiba, with the Marines that year, and Ichiro Suzuki. Had 25 home runs. It's hard to imagine, but Ichiro Suzuki was three home runs away from a triple crown because he tied Tanaka and Hatsushiba with 80 RBIs. Wow. The three guys with 25 home runs and 85 RBIs. One of them was Ichiro Suzuki. That was his, I'm going to say that was his second straight Pacific League MVP award winning year. And his second of seven straight PL batting titles, but that's the closest he ever came to a triple crown.
Yeah, and I just, my image of the guy is, this is a guy who hits 30 to 40 home runs all the time, but you look at his numbers in his career. Well, I mean,
he did that when they plopped him down at Tokyo Dome with the ball, with the jumping bean ball.
Well, I mean, he had 36 home runs in 97, he had 31 in 2000, he had 44 in 2001, and then 32 in 2002, and 41 in 2004. So, I mean, he had some big home run numbers, but since 34 home runs in 2005 with the Giants, he hasn't been above 30.
Right.
He's barely been above 20.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, my image of the guy was this, but I mean, it hit me last year during the Japan Series. This is not a power hitter. This is just a guy who has turned into a guy who can drive the ball over the infield.
Yep.
And split some gaps once in a while. And, if you really miss location bad, he can hurt you, but, he's not that power hitter from before. So I think he's going to meander kind of toward the 2000 mark, but, maybe get a hot streak, but I think we're looking.
He doesn't need that many, man.
Well, I think he needs about 25 and he's not playing every day.
That's the thing. Well, he's not playing because they have too many guys who can play, and they can't,
That would certainly hamper you getting a hit.
It does indeed. I mean, and Akiyama's only way to out of that solution, short of using a bullet, a couple of speedy two bullets, is, spread the playing time around.
Yeah, and so I don't think, I think we're looking at sometime in June before he gets there. I don't think.
Okay.
I don't think it's going to be that soon.
Well, I don't think he's going to complain if he gets it in June.
Complain? No. But, I mean, the other guys are going to get there before he does, and he's going to be bringing up the rear. So, maybe.
Well, look at this way. He's not going to lose a race to Tanishiga. How embarrassing would that be? Although Tanishiga, to be honest, was playing in 19. He was playing when the team was still the Taiyo Whales.
All right. Well, good luck to those guys, the milestoners, and
okay.
Hope that they hit their marks quickly and
yep, too much. Indeed, get it out of the way.
And on different nights, don't have it where your two guys are on the same night.
No, don't do that.
Have your own night, guys.
Unless it's before May 16th.
All right. Another topic I wanted to get to was this weird play. At QVC Marine Field. Now,
I smell a rant coming on.
And I smell a disagreement, but let me try to set the picture. There was a runner on second. The Lions were playing the Marines. The runner on second base with less than two outs was Kuriyama. And Hiroyuki Nakajima was at the plate. And he hit a line drive to center field. The Marine center fielder Okada goes back and he has to catch the ball on the dead run, which he does.
Yep.
On the warning track, and his next couple steps take him into the wall.
Yep.
He has caught the ball and Kiyota comes over from right field and Okada flips the ball to Kiyota and Kiyota starts the relay. Well, that actually started the relay. Kiyota hits the relay man, and they get the ball back. Meanwhile, Kuriyama decided he was going to touch up, and he was going to go around third, and he's going to try to score on this fly ball to center.
Right.
And, the throw ended up bouncing away from the catcher, and it wasn't even really that close a play. Kuriyama was safe.
Right.
And I look at the score box, and it says sacrifice fly for Nakajima. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. This is utterly ridiculous. There's no sacrifice happening here. You know, this guy was taking his normal at-bat, trying to get a hit, trying to drive the gap, but at least trying to hit a line drive somewhere. He's not giving himself up. So I know the scores have to account for the base. They have to account for Kuriyama going from third to home.
Right.
And so they give him a sacrifice fly. Now, your argument before we started taping was that you didn't care and that they had to give him a sacrifice fly because it was a sacrifice fly. And hardly anybody is trying to get a sacrifice fly. They're always trying to just get a hit.
Yes.
But this does not sit with me well. I don't like this stat anyway.
So
this so-called sacrifice fly.
So you wouldn't give a sacrifice to a guy who tries to bunt his way on because he's trying to bunt his way on.
You know what? Even that, I would say, hey, look, let's let the scorers decide. Put it in the scorers' hands. And they usually do a bad job in Japan anyway, but, I mean, most of the guys do. Let's be honest.
Okay.
But they would get enough of those right to where, you know, guys, if they were really trying to sacrifice, you know, well, I'm having not an epiphany, but an idea come to me now, but we'll talk about that on our future show. Certainly, if they really are trying to sacrifice, only the managers know, only the guy who's at the plate really knows. But I mean, you can tell most of the time the way they hold the bat, and you know, if they're
sure.
two steps out of the box before the bat floating in the air makes contact with the ball. I mean, tell sometimes.
Okay.
But this is separate from bunts. If a guy's really, I mean, you can tell on a bunt that a guy is actually trying to give himself up, especially when the direction of the bunt, if they're really trying to push it down a certain way, you can tell if they're giving themselves up.
Yeah.
But in this case, there was no give up. There was no sacrifice taking place yet. He gets, you know, he essentially
it's
gets
after the fact.
Not at bat for no at bat.
Right.
You know, it's not going to hurt his average, which can't take too much more of a beating, I don't think.
Well, Mike, have you run out of steam there?
Yes, sir. Well, for now.
Okay. My thinking of is. It's going to hurt your – I know for players it is important. You know, you don't want to hurt your batting average. But the idea is not whether it's going to hurt your batting average, but whether it's going to help you win the game. So that's number one. Now, number two, the sacrifice as we know it today is an accident. It's a mistake. It's – which to me is – it's so much – It's so Japanese baseball. The sacrifice originated, and I'll use the sacrifice is a term coined by the father of baseball.
Mm-hmm.
You do know who the father of baseball was?
I cannot answer that.
Okay, a man whose name was Henry Chadwick.
Henry Chadwick.
And he was a cricket-playing immigrant to New York.
I remember his name.
He wrote down the rules, the first official rules of the New York Knickerbocker Baseball Athletic Club, which had one of the first baseball teams. It wasn't actually a first baseball team. There was a lot of baseball played with a lot of different games that may or may not have been baseball. But anyway, he essentially codified the baseball rules. And he called the sacrifice, essentially, a sacrifice was an at-bat in which you tried to put the ball in play in order to get a hit. You tried to get a hit because nobody would put the ball in play so as not to get on base.
Well,
but
okay.
You put the ball, you tried to get a hit in such a way that if the ball were caught, a runner would be able to advance. So you weren't trying to make an out. You were trying to, let's put it this way, make productive outs in, essentially you're trying to hit behind the runner.
Yeah, you're trying to.
That was a sacrifice. Now.
You were not trying to directly get a hit, but if a hit was a result.
No. You were trying to get a hit.
Okay.
But you were trying to get a hit. You were trying to hit behind the runner, essentially.
Okay.
So the runner could advance. That was a sacrifice. Now, what happened was a problem with language occurred. And people got hung up on the idea that a sacrifice was noble, and it became a competition, a sort of a, oh, I don't know what you can call it, a kind of a little cult religion going on within baseball that sacrifices, making outs, were noble and beneficial to the cause of winning games. Now, where does that sound come in? Mm. Now, American baseball has kind of gotten out of that by necessity. And Japanese baseball has not. The idea that the sacrifice is a good thing is just a mistaken language. It was a misinterpretation of the rule. So the idea of a sacrifice is sort of a bastardization of what it was originally meant to be, which is just put the ball in play where it'll do the most good.
Well, I know some guys can go up there and they can look for certain pitches and they can try to put certain swings on them, maybe to get the ball to the outfield if there's a runner on third. But
sure. That's situational.
But there's no guarantee. And like last week in the interview, John Balker said the same thing. Essentially, he told us that it doesn't, you know, you can't control what happens after that. You're just trying to get good wood on the ball. You can't control where it goes. And so.
Exactly. But usually with the sacrifice, I mean, when the prototypical sacrifice is a pitch, a pitch up and away rather than in, something you can drive, you know, you can hit in the air. And after that, if that's the ball you get, you put a good swing on and hope it goes where you want. But, I agree with you.
Yeah.
That it isn't a sacrifice, most people aren't trying to, oddly enough, the sacrifice fly is, in most cases, exactly what the original meaning of the sacrifice was. The guy is not trying to make it out.
Yeah. Well,
he's trying to advance a runner with a hit, but hit the ball so that if it is caught, the runner will still be able to advance. The bunt is the weird thing. So I think what we should do is not fix the sacrifice fly, but fix the bunt.
Throw them all out.
Exactly. That was the throw out. So anyway, so that's kind of that's my take on that. Is it important? Yeah. Well, sure. They should change the rules.
All right.
Okay. But anyway, yeah. And John says so. That's good enough for me.
All right. Well, tell us what you guys think, because I'm kind of sick of these sacrifice flies for guys trying to hit home runs and falling up short, or having a guy who's really fast on a shallow fly ball hit to a guy who has a weak throwing arm. And they're given a sacrifice fly for those. So, tell us what you think. Let's go to fielding questions. All right. It sounds like our friend out in Tokorozawa is fuming, and
yeah,
more so than me. Let's take a listen to his question.
Hi, John and Jim. This is Mike from Tokorozawa. In fact, I am at Tokorozawa train station right now, waiting to catch my ride to work and hoping that Nabe Q is on one of these slow trains out of town, and that's where my question comes in this week. I'm wondering, is it too early in the season to fire a manager? Because I really think the Lions need something to shake them up. Maybe a little bit too early. John, you're probably right that jumping off the bandwagon this early is rushing it a bit, but I really think the Lions are dreadful and need something to shake them up. Let me know, guys. Love the show. Bye.
Woo! All right, Mike. Well,
heads would roll if Mike were running the Lions.
Off with his head! I can understand, and this question came in, I think, on Tuesday morning, and I think that was after a Monday loss, which ended up where the Lions were 0-6 at home. That's their worst start in club history. They were 20 runs for and 39 against, so they were being outscored 2-1 just about. Their team batting average actually dipped below 200 the other day. That's last in the league. The 20 runs were the fewest in the league. The team ERA is the highest in Japan. What a mess! But I don't think you can fire the manager.
Well, sure you can. The Lions have never had an interim manager, so since the team was formed before the 1950 season have they ever had two managers in the same season. So that would be record, that would be groundbreaking.
Historic, yeah.
It would be. Well, there were actually, to be honest, there aren't that many interim managers in Japan. There are probably a few dozen. So anyway, how much is it his fault? I think it's just a bad combination of everything going wrong. I haven't seen, you know, I haven't watched, really had a chance to see much of what the Lions are doing.
You haven't missed much. I'm sorry to say, you haven't missed much. Well, they're not hitting. And, you know, the other thing that I was talking to one of the beat writers, and I said, well, I mean, are they doing the little things? You know, and I watched them the other night, and I watched a little bit of the game today. And, you know, for them to get runners on and get them over, and, you know, you want to get them on, get them over, get them in. Well, they're not getting them on.
Right.
They're not getting a lot of walks. I think I looked up their walks, their total walks and hits combined, and that was the fewest in Japan. I mean, they're not getting guys on. And then when they get the guys on in front of the bigger guys, those guys are not hitting. I mean, Okawari-kun is hitting 191 or something, you know, going into Sunday's game. So, right. I mean, you know, they're just struggling. But I've seen this before when a team is bad, all bad together. It's all good together. And when they get good together, that's really going to, I mean, they're going to be unstoppable. I think the one issue is, I guess there's two issues, but there's two issues, and one of them is that they're not hitting, but the other one is they're not pitching well in terms of starters. Walkley, I asked everybody I could ask on the sidelines the other day, one of the coaches, I asked a couple writers, and they said he's not injured, that they sent him down, they deactivated him because he's not pitching well. And, but
sure
then
enough.
They don't have guys to, they don't have, Oishi's not pitching well on the farm.
Right.
Kikuchi is just, he's just not there. I mean, one of the, his ERA was 4.5 or something. And I mean, they just don't have anybody to bring up to who's going to be able to contribute as much as a Walkui on the first team. So yeah, it's bad. And they're having a bad start. What are they? 4-11. So they're getting to an area that I don't like to be in, which is 10 games under 500. And they're pushing that.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah, well, who does?
But it's so early, and it's still
exactly.
You know, and I just, you know, they don't fire managers in Japan that often.
They do, but they don't. No, they. I mean, they do it, but just it's pretty rare.
Yeah,
they'll wait till the end of the season.
I would venture to say that Bobby Valentine would get fired before Nobuyuki gets fired.
It happened.
And I don't see Bobby getting fired either. So I just, when was the last guy forced out? I think it was Akihiko Oya in Yokohama.
Oh, well, we had a guy quit. Or maybe he didn't quit. I don't remember.
Well, he was forced out, I mean.
Oh, I'm talking about Takada.
Takada. That was in the off season, or was it?
No, it was in May.
It was in May. Well, yeah, he was forced out too. See, I didn't even, in Yokohama, things in Yokohama, they, you know. It's surreal.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, Terry Collins quit.
He walked away. It just doesn't happen a lot. So the shakeup that they need is somebody to start hitting on a regular basis. And once somebody, you know, hits, then it'll catch fire. But they need a spark. And
I am eager to see them because I did like what I saw in the spring. And for things to suddenly be so bad is kind of interesting. You know, well, spring is what it is, and the season is what it is, and there's not necessarily a connection between the two. But, I really am eager to go up and see what's going on and see what people are saying. So,
me too. So I hope to see him soon, and we hope to hear from you guys soon. Thank you very much for listening to the show. Please send your questions to yakyujohn@gmail.com, and we'll get them on the show. MP3s, everybody, MP3s, and we'll play them.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
All right, thanks for listening. Thanks a lot, Jim. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Yeah, good to be back.
Enjoy your baseball, everyone.